I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair met this morning with President George Bush at the White House. It's their first meeting in 5 months. Topping the agenda, the war in Iraq and Israeli-Palestinian relations. Joining us on the line from the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London is Rosemary Hollis. She heads the Middle East program there. Welcome, Dr. Hollis.
Thank you.
Well, where should we start? There are two topics in front of these gentlemen. Which do you think is the most pressing for them?
I think on the Arab-Israeli conflict, Blair has been convinced that the war on terrorism won't succeed unless the United States and its allies are seen to be even-handed in their dealings with Palestinian rights as well as Israeli security needs.
And we know that just last Tuesday, President Bush met with the Israeli Prime Minister and backed Israeli plans to forge a deal with the Palestinians without the Palestinians' involvement in it. British press reports are saying that Blair doesn't think that's a good idea but had no influence over his ally. Do you think that Tony Blair had consulted with President Bush in the last week before President Bush's announcement?
The line taken is that they talk frequently. It's also the case that Ariel Sharon visited Tony Blair, and he must have known something from that conversation about what was intended. So it may not have come as a complete surprise to Tony Blair, and he was beginning to prepare the ground by making positive noises about the potential of the Israeli initiative to kickstart the peace process. This is not going to be about bearing of the soul. This is not going to be about scoring points. This is a reaffirmation of the strength and importance of the U.S.-British relationship. And whatever Tony Blair says to George Bush in private, he's not telling us.
Well, now to Iraq. Tony Blair met with U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan last night to discuss how to get the U.N. involved in Iraq in time for the handover. At a very terrible time in the history of Iraq, the violence, the kidnappings this week, how has the Prime Minister responded to those?
In the Sunday papers last Sunday, Tony Blair expressed his opinion. He wrote the article himself. He was tough, defiant. We're going to face down the opposition in Iraq. If Iraq doesn't succeed, then it'll send entirely the wrong message around the world, and so on. My sense is that that's not how the British forces, the British Foreign Office, the British public, indeed, are seeing things this week.
And even members of his own party.
Certainly not members of the Prime Minister's own party, but he's always had rebels within the party. So it's a question of reconciling the need for showing resolution, the need for solidarity with the United States, and the very clear advice from the front, from the British establishment, that unless the policy has changed somewhat, it's not going to work.
Which man needs which man most?
The way the United States has dealt with its special friend, Britain, one gets the impression that Britain is pretty much dispensable. It was obviously nice to have, but Donald Rumsfeld on the eve of war was the one who said, well, if necessary, we can go without the Brits. It's not that big a deal. I don't think at that stage the Americans realized how much they would need international support in picking up the pieces after the war. From the British point of view, the objective was always to be indispensable in Washington because Britain would have a strong relationship in Europe. And it was never intended that Britain would have to end up choosing between the two major interests, friendship with the United States and a leadership role in Europe. But that's how it's worked out.
Dr. Hollis, thank you.
Thank you.
Rosemary Hollis heads the Middle East program at the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London.
The White House is considering appointing a new overall director of national intelligence, an intelligence czar, according to a report in today's New York Times. The 9/11 Commission has faulted a lack of coordination between intelligence agencies for allowing the terrorist attacks of 2001 to happen. Now, the idea of an intelligence czar is not new. Republican former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, Scowcroft, Senator John Kerry, and Congressman Jane Harman, the senior Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, have all advanced similar proposals. But CIA Director George Tenet has expressed opposition. But we're joined now by another skeptic. Reuel Marc Gerecht is a former CIA Middle East intelligence analyst and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Welcome, Reuel.
Good day.
Reuel, bipartisan support for this idea. What do you think of it?
I'm not terribly fond of it. I mean, I think I'm in a rather odd position here that I find myself in agreement with Director Tenet. I think it's more or less a game of musical chairs here. It doesn't really go to the heart of the issue, and that is the systemic problems in both the clandestine service and in the analytical wing of the agency, the Director of Intelligence. I don't think appointing a new super bureaucrat will affect the quality of the human intelligence that is collected overseas or its analysis back at Langley.
Still, Reuel, even if this intelligence czar wasn't able as a single person to improve intelligence gathering, this is about coordinating all the intelligence that's gathered. I mean, why shouldn't there be one person in charge of that?
Well, because I think the actual bureaucratic effect of it will be to increase the quantity of paper. I mean, the intelligence community already is just flooded in it. There is a very bad American reflex, and it's very much an American reflex, to handle these issues by believing that you somehow have to supplement what you already have. You have to, one, either increase the number of officers in the field, increase the analysts, and increase the management. I think that's fundamentally wrong. I think we would be better off if we go in the opposite direction by actually having a smaller, much more elite intelligence service that approaches our problems much more realistically and much more aggressively.
But the CIA knew about some of the 9/11 hijackers, for example. The FBI wasn't told. The FBI knew things the CIA wasn't told. How do you change that?
I mean, that is, I think, much more an issue of making mid-level managers responsible. But when I mean responsible, that is, if they mess up, then they should be fired. That's a much more intelligent approach to make what we already have more efficient rather than way up on, top. It is much easier, for example, to appoint an intelligence czar. It sounds good, and the sort of business school mentality that you have in Washington, it's very appealing. And it's much easier than, say, looking at seriously the number of case officers in the clandestine service, how they're posted overseas, whether many of them are doing any work at all, and thinking about, all right, how do you actually seriously recruit agents inside of an Islamic terrorist group? The answers to those questions could entail that, one, a lot of people get fired, we have to change the culture inside of the institution, and that you have to act in a fairly revolutionary, painful way. And it's very, very difficult for people in Congress or in the executive branch to deal with these issues, and they're always potentially embarrassing to deal with these issues.
In the wake of the 9/11 Commission, do you think that revolution will happen in the intelligence agencies and all the entities that gather intelligence to protect us?
If I had to bet, I would say no. There have been many efforts that I am aware of in the last 20 years to engage in reform. It happens every 2 or 3 years at the agency, and the CIA in particular has the resilience of a cockroach.
Reuel Marc Gerecht is a former CIA Middle East intelligence analyst and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Reuel, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Nuclear equipment, much of it contaminated, is being smuggled out of Iraq and into Europe. That's according to the Director General of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. Mohammed El-Baradei says satellite photos show large amounts of scrap, equipment, and in some cases entire buildings being removed. Warren Levinson covers the United Nations for the Associated Press. He joins us from New York.
It's not at all clear. Mohammed El-Baradei is fairly circumspect in this letter to the Security Council. Remember that the IAEA left Iraq as the United States moved in more than a year ago. This information that he's got in this letter comes from, as you say, satellite images and examination of stuff that's turned up on ships coming into European ports and at European scrapyards. So it's not at all clear.
Well, he writes in the letter, as we read, that it's not clear whether the removal of these items has been the result of looting or systematic efforts to clean up contaminated nuclear sites. Who would be undergoing systematic efforts to clean up contaminated sites in Iraq in this war-torn moment?
Again, you have to be careful about what you say, because it's hard to imagine who's got time when the electricity isn't even on in most places, or I shouldn't say in most places, but in many places, to actually start nuclear cleanup. It does sound a very ominous note, but again, El Baradei can't make any definitive statement about what's been going on, because neither he nor his people have been on the ground in Iraq for some 13 months.
And that leads to the next question. How is this possible that there's no one guarding these areas?
It's entirely possible that there's no one guarding these areas. Again, it's not very clear. It would appear that at least some of the areas have been left unguarded. Iraq was in an enormous amount of chaos after the fall of Saddam Hussein's government. As you remember, we opened our newspapers every day or saw on our television screens or heard on the radio reports of vast amounts of looting. Anything that wasn't nailed down got hauled away. And so it's not exactly a surprise that, although it's a frightening revelation, that it could be that could have extended to nuclear facilities. What's not very clear is how much nuclear material they had in those facilities. We know that the Iraqis were attempting to build at some point nuclear weapons, but it is generally believed that they were quite some distance away from actually having enough material to do it.
Well, what concerns does Mohammed al-Baradei express?
Well, the fears that he raises are that there are scientists and materials around that might be available on some kind of nuclear black market. And as it has been demonstrated, forces that would wish the United States and the rest of the West ill are eager to get their hands on various types of radioactive materials. The words dirty bomb pop to mind, not necessarily that they could build a nuclear weapon, but a kind of radiation dispersal device using conventional explosives to certainly sow panic, if not mass casualties.
Hmm. Has there been any response to the letter? Is there any sense of what the U.S. or the U.S.-led coalition in particular might do?
There is not as yet. In fact, what's interesting is that this letter is 3 weeks old. It was sent to the Security Council nearly a month ago before it finally surfaced. So it's not clear what the United States or the U.N. Security Council might do about this.
Hmm. Warren, thank you.
You bet.
Warren Levinson covers the United Nations for the Associated Press. He's speaking to us about a letter from the United Nations watchdog about nuclear-related equipment disappearing from scrap piles in Iraq.
Just ahead, one young man's attempt to meet the governor of Maryland in order to find out why tuition keeps increasing at state schools. He never did meet the governor, but he made a film about trying, a la Roger and Me.
And later in the program, did the media fail in the months and years leading up to 9/11?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
1989's endearingly low-tech documentary film, Roger and Me, chronicled curmudgeonly filmmaker Michael Moore's quest to talk face-to-face with General Motors CEO Roger Smith.
Hi, may I help you?
Yes, we've been looking for Roger Smith, and we're wondering if he was here right now.
Okay, I have no idea whether he's here or not, but you are going to have to leave with Flint.
Moore blamed the decline of his beloved hometown, Flint, Michigan, on GM closing factories there. Well, now there's a new, even more low-tech film inspired by Roger and Me. It's called Bob and Me, Bob being Maryland Governor Bob Ehrlich. The film's auteur is Tim Daly, a 22-year-old senior and student body president at the University of Maryland. Here's a scene from the film.
My name is Tim Daly. I'm the student body president at the University of Maryland, and Governor Ehrlich hasn't accepted any of my my request to meet with him over the last 5 months, and I was hoping I might be able to speak with him.
You have to make an appointment.
Well, but the problem is...
You want to interview him?
Well, I just want to talk to him. I mean, for the last 5 months, I've sent faxes and emails and phone calls, and I got one phone call return and an email return, and then that was it.
Have you talked to someone in the governor's press office?
Well, yeah, that's who I emailed, and I also emailed his scheduler and his fax scheduler.
Well, we're joined now by Tim Daly. Tim, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Tim, Michael Moore pursued the CEO of GM. You pursue the governor of Maryland. How come?
Well, you know, when Governor Ehrlich was elected in November 2002, you know, there was a lot of promises made about, you know, different programs he was going to support. And one of the things he said was he was going to support public higher education. Well, shortly after being elected, unfortunately, over the course of the last 18 months, public higher education has been cut by hundreds of millions of dollars, forcing tuition increases of 21.7% last year, 11.4% at the beginning of this year, and we're expecting another 10% for next fall. All said and told, under Governor Ehrlich's watch, we've seen tuition increases of over 40% in an aggregate effect. And so what we decided to do, after I was elected student body president last April, was to really bring this issue to the forefront of people's minds. And so that's what we did. And we organized some rallies and some grassroots campaigning. And it really came to a head when in June of last year, Governor Ehrlich was quoted in the Washington Post as saying, "If you can afford a Cadillac, that's terrific. But for some folks, you need to start off with a Pinto." And Governor Ehrlich was talking about the budget. And what we decided to do was say, if that's how Governor Ehrlich feels about the budget, and you know, by looking at it further, that's what he's saying we feel as if about public higher education, we need to show him what exactly he wants to our public higher education system to be. So one day, we showed up at 2 p.m. and dropped off a 1979 white Ford Pinto wagon in front of his house and had a little protest there just to show what exactly his priorities were. And obviously, those did not include public higher education.
So let me get this straight. You cut over $100 million in a year, and then you put your name on all the signs?
You try to talk to the governor on your radio show.
That's
you go
right.
up to the gates of the governor's mansion where he lives.
Right.
You try just about everything. Why do you think the governor won't talk to you?
Unfortunately, a week before his appearance on the show, he canceled it. And that was really very discouraging. You know, we're not too sure. We have spent a great amount of time trying to reach out to the governor's office. My predecessor had done the same thing.
What's it cost to go to the University of Maryland now?
Well, for an in-state student, it's costing close to $7,000 in tuition alone. That doesn't include an additional $1,300 in mandatory fees. And if you want to live on campus, that's another $8,000 or $9,000 between your room and board.
Now, Tim, your movie goes on to another level. You go, as we said, attempting in a number of places to try to get to the governor.
That's
and
right.
then you go up to Wilmington, Delaware, and
that's
you
right.
go to the second floor of a building at 1105 Market Street.
That's right.
What's that all about?
Well, you know, the governor always says, well, you can't just say don't cut public higher education. You need to provide an alternative, right? Well, what would you do? That's the response when they would say things in the newspaper about
yep.
you know, a protest that we had. So we said, well, this is what we would do. We would say that those corporations like Toys R Us and Burger King, what they do is they set up shell corporations in Delaware, which has no corporate income tax. And what they'll do is they'll share the revenue from the College Park of Burger King and they'll transfer it to the Burger King headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, where they don't have any taxes to pay off of it. So what we did was we pointed this out. We brought a budget expert in to talk about this issue. And then we got into that building where allegedly over 600 corporations are, quote unquote, headquartered. Yet when we got there, there was not a single employee to be found.
Well, it looks like there was a company here.
How much money does it cost the state of Maryland that these companies are able to shelter themselves from corporate taxes?
Sure. You know, that's really hard to say, actually. There's some very conservative estimates, and the reason why I say that is because not necessarily is this public information. And so any number that we come up with would be on the low end. We have no idea how vast this accounting technique goes. But we have estimated that every year the state of Maryland could collect excess of $100 million of tax revenue.
Has the governor changed his attitude towards speaking to you guys since this film apparently has become so well known in Maryland?
Sure. You know, not yet. We're reaching out to him, and still we're still getting the same response, which is, well, we're sorry, no one is available to talk to you right now.
You're not allowed on private property. This is private property.
Okay.
So what I'm going to ask you all to do is please move off of Comcast property.
Okay. Is there
if
there's somebody from
that? And my next option is to call the county police and have them escorted.
Well, their budget's been cut the same as the higher education's budget, so they'll probably have problems coming out here.
It's discouraging, but during the course of this whole thing, we've picked up a number of key allies through this organizing and activism. Now the Speaker of the Legislature, because of some of the things that we've been doing, has made public higher education one of his top three legislative priorities. So with allies like that, like the Speaker of the Legislature, we think that that we can continue to put pressure on the governor, and hopefully he'll respond.
Tim, you're a very well-spoken 22-year-old guy, but you're still a 22-year-old guy. And when you walked up, for example, to the governor's mansion and you pressed that buzzer for the intercom, were you nervous at all?
I wasn't too nervous about it because we really felt very passionately about this. And we needed to make a statement, and we needed to make sure that we could communicate this message and this issue to as many people as possible. And so we did it, and I'm really happy that we did because I think it came out pretty well.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
Well, geez, I graduate in May, so I guess it's no longer what do I want to be when I grow up. It's kind of what do I want to do now. So I plan on going to law school. I'm taking a year off before I do. And I'm looking to do I'm on the job market right now, just trying to find a job just like every other college graduate right now. But it's not the easiest times to do that, unfortunately.
Tim Daly is the student body president at the University of Maryland and creator of the film Bob and Me.
Next time on Here and Now, we speak to one of the lost boys of Sudan. After traveling thousands of miles, he'll run 26 in the Boston Marathon.
And reenacting the American Revolution. Sometimes it's all about having the right clothes. That's next time.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Earlier this week, we spoke to Gary Hart. Between 1998 and 2001, the former senator and one-time Democratic presidential candidate co-chaired the Hart-Rubin Commission on National Security. The commission issued its report in January of 2001. And this week, Hart told us he spent 9 months, up until 9/11, trying to get anyone to pay attention to the report's warnings about terrorism.
I was meeting closed doors everywhere I went. And I just felt, other than trying to alert the public and the press, by the way, and that's a subject we could discuss because the press in America didn't do nearly enough to warn the American people either.
Let's discuss it. Why not?
Well, you'd have to ask members of the press.
Yeah.
Call up the New York Times and ask them why, when we issued our final report, they didn't print one word of it in their newspaper.
Former Senator Gary Hart speaking with Bill Delaney earlier this week. Well, we contacted the New York Times for comment. We're told their statement reads, "There's nothing we can say without knowing the specifics of whom he called or how he called it to our attention, and we will follow up on that." But the very question Senator Hart asks is a good one. So now we'd like to pose it to members of this week's editorial roundtable. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C., Josh Meyer, reporter for the L.A. Times and a terrorism expert. Josh, welcome.
Hi.
And Danny Schechter, journalist and co-founder of Global Vision and author of the book Media Wars. He speaks to us from New York. Hi, Danny.
Okay, what a joke. I have to respond to that. He didn't call it to our attention. Isn't that the newspaper's job to cover events like this? You know, I read about his report right before 9/11 in Montreal, Canada. It was published in a newspaper in Quebec City, but not in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, at that time, what was being reported was shark attacks on CNN and the Gary Condit sex scandal. And there was no time for any of this.
Danny Schechter with obviously a very strong opinion on this topic. But Josh Meyer, how do you feel about that? You were writing about terrorism in the L.A. Times long before 9/11.
I did, Robin. And I'm probably the last person that would ever want to be an apologist for the New York Times. I mean, being competitors of mine. I will have to say, though, that I can't comment on what they did about the Hart-Rubin Commission. But the New York Times did do an excellent series in early 2001 on the growth of radical Islam and Al Qaeda, and
doesn't Danny's point stand that it really shouldn't be Gary Hart's job,
right,
to bring a report to the attention of the New York Times? The New York Times should be interested in that report.
Oh, absolutely, and And I think that the reason I mentioned the New York Times series was because that was very much the exception rather than the rule. I think most papers and certainly network news ignore the subject of terrorism. And
well, but you yourself – oh, go ahead, Danny.
There's patterns here of coverage. The L.A. Times itself did a terrific media reporting on an 80% cutback in coverage of the world over a pattern of some 15 years on American television. So it's not surprising that terrorism wasn't covered. Very little about the world was being covered except where the United States was directly involved.
And, Josh, what happened when you did write about terrorist threats or something like an Al-Qaeda story? You had a very long story in the L.A. Times before 9/11. Tell us about that, and what happened? What was the response to that?
I did write a very, very long piece. It was probably three or four full inside pages of the paper in early 2001 about the growth of Al-Qaeda and how it was coming to the U.S., and there were sleeper cells in the United States that the government was very concerned about. And then I continued to write about that throughout the summer. The U.S. government was absolutely freaked out about Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, and there was a guy named Richard Clark who, when I showed up at his office, said, you know, thank God you're here. Nobody else, wants to, talk about this. But
did people think you were crazy?
Well, I mean, after 9/11, I had several friends and even editors tell me, take me aside and say, well, you know, we didn't want to tell you this before 9/11, but we thought you'd finally gone off the deep end and were paranoid and obsessed and so on. But, I think that's the perception of people beforehand to this issue.
Dan, I want to ask you a little bit about that. How much did the press also have what we're hearing through the 9/11 Commission that many in the administration had, which is sort of a Cold War mentality? So eyes fixed in the wrong direction.
You know, I think that's true. I mean, Richard Clark himself, let's not forget, was quite a hawk. He was quite an advocate of preemptive, strikes and preemptive action. But I think it is true that just as he calls, for an investigation of the failures of U.S. policy, I think there are people in the media who have to begin to think about an investigation of the role of the media in all of this. I think the fact that there was a lack of priority to this story, as to so many others, around the world, is a sign of irresponsibility on a massive scale.
But you know that every reporter, if they could have found the Al-Qaeda attack and the Osama bin Laden plans before 9/11, would have done anything, sold anything, to get it. So, they would have wanted that story. So what is it?
Tens of thousands of people were passing through those Al-Qaeda camps, we're told, being trained. The coverage of it was, extremely minimal. The warlord battling and the killing in Afghanistan was a story in the back of the papers. It wasn't something we paid much attention to. Just as the government abandoned Afghanistan, so did the media. And this is one of the problems, and a tendency to march in lockstep with what the government is saying and doing, and to have its master narrative influence our master narrative.
Josh, Danny makes a point in one of his columns that sometimes the media also doesn't hear something when the usual soloist is singing it, but when it's another member of the choir, they pay more attention. That is, Richard Clark was perceived as a hawk when he came out and spoke the way he did. Daniel Ellsberg before him, years before. What did you write, Danny? He was a member of the RAND Corporation.
Yeah, in other words, you have to be sort of an insider to be taken seriously. If you're an outsider, you tend not to be.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but I will say that covering the 9/11 Commission hearings, as I have over the last couple of weeks, is that every day I probably get about 100 conspiracy theory emails and phone calls from people. It's hard to sort of sift through all that, especially when the hearings are going on. Robin, I'm not sure where your question was going on that, but I think what you were talking about was sort of the pack mentality of journalists. And I think there's two problems here. One is that most journalists, I think, really like to be sort of spoon-fed information, and they don't really question, what goes on behind that. And the second thing is that even when there is spoon-fed information out there, I think that there hasn't been an interest in it. Maybe it wasn't that sexy of a story. I mean, I was covering the Ahmed Rassam trial in Los Angeles.
This is the thwarted Millennium attack.
At the Millennium, and I can tell you that there were no reporters who stayed almost for the entire trial. And even the embassy bombing trial in New York, which was regarding the deaths of 224 people at two U.S. embassies in Africa, That was going on in 2001, and there was very little coverage of that from the
Well, you know why? Because the Puffy Combs trial was going on at the same time.
Right.
So there were
right.
500 TV trucks and journalists covering that trial,
right.
and the terrorist trial was all but ignored, which was shocking,
right.
you know, in light of what was to happen next. And
well,
it shows the priorities that are often, you know, kind of out of whack.
We're
right.
going to have to let that depressing note be the last one. I want to thank you both.
Okay.
Thank you
sure.
both. Josh Meyer, reporter for the L.A. Times. Danny Schechter, journalist, co-founder of Global Vision, and author of the book Embedded Weapons of Mass Deception, How the Media Failed to Cover the War in Iraq.
Well, still to come, moving on to something completely different, we review the new Quentin Tarantino film, Kill Bill, Volume 2.
You're listening to Here and Now. This weekend, over 200 women from 23 countries will embark on a bicycle trip, but the bike trail of choice may be more treacherous than the usual trek. They'll be pedaling from Beirut, Lebanon, through Syria and Jordan. Joining us now are Octavia Taylor. Hello.
Hi.
We're also joined by Cheryl Wolf. Hi there.
Hi.
Two women who are going to be participating in the tour this weekend. And Octavia, start with you. Why are you doing this?
There needs to be an American presence in this group of women. It's a little diplomatic mission, if you will. It's important among all the other women from all over Europe and the Middle East to have an American presence to show that not everybody is in support of the current policies.
Well, it's an organization called Follow the Women. And Cheryl, I'm wondering, you're going on the trip as well. I know there's going to be a two-day conference at the end of it. And the idea is to attract attention specifically to the way that conflict affects women. How do you do that with a bike ride?
Bike riding isn't the common thing, especially for women in the Mideast.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, 230 women from 23 countries on their bikes, this is definitely going to attract attention, Octavia.
It is, and that's the whole idea for the ride. I mean, the people who thought up of this idea, I think, had a good sense of humor, the whole idea of seeing these women on bicycles.
But are you worried that there may also be some backlash towards it? I mean, there might be men in particular in this area of the world who don't want to see women on bicycles, especially 230 of them.
There may be a few men who might not like to see that. On the other hand, I think that feel very comfortable that security is pretty good and that will be more of a curiosity.
I'm wondering, I mean, I'm thinking of bike outfits that we see bikers here in the States wear. Are you going to modify them for some of these parts of the country where, you know, women are not seen?
Well, that's been a point of discussion as we go along. Certainly slacks are all right, and anything that isn't sleeveless will be acceptable. So it won't be that different from what I would wear biking around here.
So you're aware, Octavia, that there might be cultural concerns, but is that part of the point to demonstrate that women can do things like that? Or
absolutely. I think that there's this rising want to participate in sports and be part of what had been previously a male world.
Will you be talking to people along the way, Cheryl?
I hope so. A lot of women, Arab women, have learned how to ride bikes just to partake in this ride.
And Octavia, you said at the outset that part of what you wanted to do is demonstrate that not everyone backs the U.S. role in the current conflicts in the Middle East. And you know, some would ask, this whole event is being sponsored in part by the wives of the leaders of Lebanon and Syria. And are you going to ask them about their country's own human rights abuses and state-sponsored terrorism?
I think that that's a very legitimate question. I think that where at this point most countries are sponsoring terrorism at one level or another, and I think those questions need to be asked of everybody, not just of one nation versus another.
Are Jewish women going to be biking with you?
They are not. Jewish citizens are not allowed to go into Syria. So there are rides that are planned in Israel. I believe they've already had a ride, and then there will be another ride in the fall. We are equally concerned about Israeli women and children as we are about Palestinian women and children. It is just that this ride does not permit us to ride both in Israel and Syria.
Yeah. We want to thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Octavia Taylor and Cheryl Wolf, members of the Follow the Women Bike Tour through the Middle East this weekend. To follow their progress, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Quick, name your top five favorite film characters. How about Rick Blaine in Casablanca or Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard? Mrs. Robinson, James Bond, Hannibal Lecter, Norman Bates, King Kong, Annie Hall. Here she is after playing tennis with Woody Allen's Alvy Singer.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
Diane Keaton as Annie Hall. Great film characters. The list is endless. Well, no, actually, it stops at 100 in Premier Magazine's celebration of the 100 greatest movie characters of all time. And Glenn Kenny, senior editor and chief film critic, joins us on the line to talk about it. Glenn, how much fun did you guys have putting this together?
It's kind of a mix of fun and trepidation because 100 seems like a huge number of characters, but no matter how many great characters you put on that list of 100, there'll be 100 more that your readers are going to tell you about that should have been there or should not have been there. So it's kind of difficult paring it down to 100, although that sounds like a big number.
You've got Dr. Strangelove on the list, Gollum from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Now, you know also you're going to be asked about how they're ranked because, well, for instance, Gollum is at number 10, a fabulous character, but some would say, well, there's Travis Bickle, Robert De Niro's taxi driver, and Ratso Rizzo of Midnight Cowboy are behind him. So
yes, well, those are three pretty skeevy guys. You know, in a lot of these cases, you're talking about characters that have stood the test of time. You know, Rick Blaine's a no-brainer. Everybody knows Rick Blaine's one of the greatest characters of all time. Gollum is a character we're betting will span the test of time, and he's a pivotal character in a film that is proven to be enormously popular and probably will endure. So if he shot up the list a little prematurely, well, that's a call we made, and we wanted to take a chance and maybe stir up a little controversy. And
well, let's have at it. I mean, you know, it's what makes it fun. Ace Ventura is on the list. John Malkovich as John Malkovich in that great film.
That's kind of fun because the character that Malkovich plays is not necessarily the real John Malkovich. The real John Malkovich doesn't sit around in an apartment with Louis XIV furniture reading Shakespeare. The real John Malkovich is more likely to be baking bread in his home in the south of France, blasting Dr. Dre from his stereo. So it is definitely a character.
Vito Corleone in The Godfather, Willy Wonka, of course, played by Gene Wilder. How did a character make the cut? I mean, what was it that made a character that memorable?
I think that it's you sort of put your head down and you think of movies that have made an impact, that are cited by readers and fans as being favorites of them, and you look at the things that make them work. You know, with a movie like The Godfather is, aside from being the greatest crime drama ever made, it is the ultimate character-driven piece because Vito Corleone is a character who has done everything for his family, and in so doing, though, he has planted the seeds of their own destruction. You know, you look at what these characters do, how their actions not only affect the action in the film, but also affect you, the viewer, as you're watching it. Mm.
Any characters that just didn't make the cut that you wish could have gotten on the list?
There's dozens, you know, and our readers remind them of us all the time.
Well, Glenn, we had one. Ruth Gordon, Harold and Maude.
Good call. It is a great character, and you could probably say that was a mistake, and that probably should have ended up in our sidebar where we had memorable pairs, which included Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and so on.
Well, it's a lot of fun. Glenn, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Glenn Kenny, senior editor and chief film critic for Premier Magazine.
Well, screenwriter and director Quentin Tarantino is known for conjuring memorable characters. In fact, Jules Winfield, played by Samuel Jackson in Pulp Fiction, was number 44 on Premier Magazine's list. But will The Bride, from his blood-soaked comic book films, Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2, forge the same time-tested connection with her audience?
Looked dead, didn't I? Well, I wasn't. But it wasn't from lack of trying, I can tell you that. Actually, Bill's last bullet put me in a coma. A coma I was to lie in for 4 years. When I woke up, I went on what the movie advertisements refer to as a roaring rampage of revenge. I roared, and I rampaged, and I got bloody satisfaction. I've killed a hell of a lot of people to get to this point, but I have only one more. The last one. The one I'm driving to right now. The only one left. And when I arrive at my destination, I am gonna kill Bill.
Uma Thurman as the Bride in Kill Bill Volume 2, which opens today. The Bride earned her nickname after surviving a brutal assassination attempt on her wedding day. And her quest for revenge on her would-be assassins is the thread that ties together both volumes of Kill Bill. The two-part production was originally slated to be released as one long film, but Miramax head Harvey Weinstein gave Tarantino the green light to chop the martial arts spaghetti western in half. Here in Now's film reviewer Eric Schaefer is in the studio to tell us what he thinks of Kill Bill Volume 2. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Bill.
Eric, you watched the first part, of course. Mm-hmm. Does this movie feel like one big movie that was just cut right in half, or does it feel like a sequel?
Right. It was, you know, originally designed as one movie, and because of various issues at Miramax, they decided to release it as two separate films.
Mostly financial issues, right?
I think so. And, you know, I have to say I'm not entirely sure it was the best idea, in part because that first volume was so high energy, was so visually interesting. You know, we talked about how it has these different styles. It looks like a samurai film in some segments. It looks like a spaghetti western in others. And he's not able to really kind of keep up that interesting visual style in the second half as it becomes a little bit more serious and as it also slows down considerably. This movie feels like it sort of had the wind knocked out of it to some extent.
How does Uma Thurman fare? Is she as bloodied in this one as she was in the last one?
Uma Thurman is great. I think she's really the main reason to see these movies. She's very compelling to watch, just as much so in this movie as she was in the first film. But I have to say that, you know, in spite of the violence in the first one, you know, it was very cartoonish. This movie, we see a lot more suffering on her part. She's buried alive in one scene. In another scene, flashback to when she was training with a kung fu master, we see her continually ramming her hand into this piece of wood over and over and over again. So there's this real loving display of her suffering, and it's kind of disturbing.
Samuel Jackson makes an appearance.
You wouldn't know it. He's on and off the screen like that, very quick. You know, there are a lot of little cameo roles in this film. But we do, of course, see Bill finally in this movie. He's just sort of a shadowy figure in the first one. And we have quite a bit of David Carradine in this movie playing Bill. And he's really doing a great job. You know, we have that trademark Tarantino dialogue, kind of rambling and inane, going nowhere. And David Carradine manages to do a lot with that dialogue. I've really got to hand it to him.
So, before this tale of bloody revenge reaches its climax, I'm going to ask you some questions, and I want you to tell me the truth. However, therein lies a dilemma. Because when it comes to the subject of me, I believe you are truly and utterly incapable of telling the truth, especially to me, and least of all, to yourself. And when it comes to the subject of me, I am truly and utterly incapable of believing anything you say.
How do you suppose we solve this dilemma?
Well, it just so happens I have a solution.
Quentin Tarantino's been Miramax's golden child, their genius. Mm-hmm. How's his reputation going to be after people go see Kill Bill 2?
Well, I think a lot of people are really going to like the movie. I think a lot of people are going to be somewhat disappointed. And ultimately, I think the only way to really judge this movie is by looking at the two films back to back. And, of course, the DVD of Volume 1 has just come out this week. You know, they'll probably put out the two together in a double volume eventually. But I have to say I was a little bit disappointed. I was surprised how much I enjoyed the first one, despite the fact that it is kind of a big bloody mess. This one was a little bit of a letdown.
Eric, thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
Eric Schaefer reviews films for Here and Now.
There's a nail in the door, and there's glass on the lawn, tacks on the floor, and the TV's on. They'll always sleep with my gun. When you're gone,
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
When I'm old and lonely, dreaming stops, and I just can't say. What should I do? Just a little baby. What if the last...
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.